But then this comes out in really fun, really funny ways of like John MacArthur's lordship idea of like, and he talks about this really in the book, like lordship salvation as like this add-on to what you need to do to be a Christian. But it's even the way it's described in those kinds of circles, though, it's like, but yeah, what's really important is that you mentally believe certain things. And so when that's the paradigm of what makes you a Christian, again, mostly in the barcode right-leaning examples here, then you do get the case of the missing teacher. You do get the absence of formation of your whole life in the church. You get the center of this, and I don't want to bash too hard here, but you get the center of, you get Zwinglianism. You get the center of the service is a 45-minute sermon on things you can think better about.
Welcome to the Belfast podcast. My name is Daniel Lee, and I'm here with Luke Byler. That's, I think, one of the first times I've done that, actually. Yeah. So
there you go.
That felt odd. So we've been talking about the divine conspiracy. We just finished up with chapter 7 and the first part of chapter 8. Chapter 7, we discussed the community of prayerful love and what it means to be a member of that community. Getting away with our contempt and our compulsion and our manipulation and trying to live into a life of invitation towards others. And then in chapter 8, we've been talking about discipleship. First, we talked about what it means to be a disciple. Now we're going to talk about what it means to make disciples. And in part of this conversation will also be being a disciple too, because these things are mutually related. But now we're going to focus a little bit more on the making than the being in discipleship. So Luke, if you want to pull up the first verses that we're going to read, Matthew 28:19-20, familiar Bible readers will recognize this as the Great Commission. Jesus' closing words in the Gospel of Matthew to us as his church. So it says, "Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to obey everything that I have commanded you. And surely I will be with you always to the very end of the age." We notice Jesus' closing benediction in Matthew. There are two things that really stand out to me. One, it's that the emphasis is on making disciples, not converts.
Mm-hmm.
And two, that these disciples are to be taught to obey everything that Jesus commanded. And it's almost as though we have a church culture that is completely, we've taken the Great Commission and we quote it all the time, but we've reshaped it into our image. Obsessed with making converts, not disciples. Obsessed with giving those converts what they want, not forming them into what they need to be full citizens of the kingdom of God. And so we've talked about what it means to be a disciple. Now we're going to talk about what it means to make disciples. A little bit, Luke, you had a nice refrain in the throughout the whole run of our last episode, talking about the fruit that is born. And so if you want to pull up the Willard quote and read this and then talk a little bit about that concept of bearing fruit and how that is tied into discipleship and formation and what it means to be a disciple and be formed and transformed into the image of Christ.
Okay. So this is from 301, near the beginning of the chapter. I'm actually going to read the little bit before this too, and then the bit that we have in the notes. And he warns us against those who would mislead us and those who look good, but inwardly, where we now know the real action lies, are governed merely by their own desires. Outwardly they look like sheep, but inwardly they're only thinking about eating sheep, that is, using us for their purposes. bearing God's name in vain. These are the ones Jesus' other little brother, Jude, describes as caring for themselves, following after their own desires, speaking arrogantly and flattering people to gain advantage. All one has to do to identify those who would mislead us, so this would be the way to not make disciples, identify those who would mislead us, is to watch what they do and pay little attention to what they say. What they do will be the unerring sign of who they are on the inside. Trees and plants manifest their nature in their fruit. Figs by bearing figs and not grapes, and what people do reveals, when thoroughly and honestly considered, the kind of person they really are. So this idea of bearing fruit, of we talk about becoming the kind of person that would fulfill the law, that would do what Jesus says, like Jesus says at the end of this in chapter 7. This is like the wise man who hears these words and does them. And this is explicit in the end of the Great Commission here, right? As you just pointed out, teaching them to obey everything I've commanded you. And Willard here is warning us, Jesus here is warning us that there are those who will say one thing and do another, and they would mislead us, but we need to be aware of them. And that it would be to watch the fruit. You will know them by their fruit. So they might say good things, but they might be someone who's filled with anger. They might preach great sermons, but they treat their subordinates with contempt. They might love to go on missions trips, but their homes are a wreck. They might say that it, I'll speak of me now. They might say it doesn't bother them, but all it does is stew anger inside of them. And so these are the things we need to be aware of when we talk about the fruit that our lives make. Be aware of those who we want to be discipled by, and be aware of our own, of the snakes inside of us, let's say, or of the sin that crouches at our own door, that is ready to devour us. Maybe that we willingly let devour us, if we are looking to disciple others. And so this is, I guess, if you want to add anything else, but this seems to be Jesus' warning here, is to watch those who you are looking to imitate, but also watch yourself.
Yeah. So on that point, I think this transitions really nicely into our next, which is, Willard phrases it, the elephant in the church. And that is that there is a lack of conscious discipleship. We're more obsessed with making converts. And I think this is actually tied to the lack of Jesus as teacher that we talked about last time, and the Gospels of sin management and how those things are related, like we talked about last time, because the ends then justify the means, like mm-hmm. we talked about last time. And so we don't have to make disciples if we're just trying to make converts. So he says on page 330, I think it's the start of this second paragraph, mm-hmm. under the yep. heading, the elephant in the church. Non-discipleship is the elephant in the church. It is not so much the much discussed moral failures, financial abuses, or amazing general similarity between Christians and non-Christians. These are only the effects of the underlying problem. That underlying problem is the lack of intentional, as we discussed, moral formation and transformation of the church further and further into the image of the Son, of Christ. And it is directly fed by what we talked about last time, these Gospels of sin management. Luke, do you have anything you wanted to add to that? I thought that was an important point to talk about when thinking about moral formation and why we need to do it, really. Let me
read the rest of this quote
yeah.
here. Because it leads into the quote I read in the last episode. He says, "The fundamental negative reality among Christian believers now is their failure to be constantly learning how to live their lives in the kingdom among us. And it is an accepted reality. The division of professing Christians into those whom it is a matter of whole life devotion to God and those who maintain a consumer or client relationship with the church has now been an accepted reality for over 1500 years." And then he talks about the Protestant Reformation's proclamation of salvation by faith alone, and how this has become baked into the good news, makes us, one doesn't have to be a lifetime student of Jesus in order to be a Christian and receive forgiveness of sins. This gives a precise meaning to the phrase cheap grace, though it would be better described as costly faithlessness. And so this idea of the things that are underneath all the moral failures, the abuses, the ways in which the church are the same as the world is because there is this case of the missing teacher. There is these gospels of sin management. Either you, what does Willard say? He says, either someone who is ready to die and face the judgment of God, or someone who is wholly committed to the eradication of social evil. That's it. There is no Jesus as teacher, how you live your life. And so when this is gone, you get the moral failures, you get the abuses, you get the fact that Christians are the same as everyone else. Because for many of us, and I would say probably many of those listening, probably came out of the more right-leaning gospels, where it's about what I believe in my head, right? The things that I mentally ascend to is what makes me a Christian, right? This is where you get the way that things will get used, as we talked about last episode, where if it's just about avoiding the fires of hell, then I will use fear to make people avoid it, to get them to pray this prayer, to mentally ascend to Jesus. I accept, whatever that means, I accept Jesus as my savior. But then this comes out in really funny ways of like John MacArthur's lordship idea of like, and he talks about this really in the book, like lordship salvation as like this add-on to what you need to do to be a Christian. But it's, even the way it's described in those kinds of circles, though, it's like, but yeah, what's really important is that you mentally believe certain things. And so when that's the paradigm of what makes you a Christian, again, mostly in the barcode right-leaning examples here, then you do get the case of the missing teacher. You do get the absence of formation of your whole life in the church. You get the center of this, and I don't want to bash too hard here, but you get the center of, you get Zwinglianism. You get the center of the service is a 45 minute sermon on things you can think better about.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
And this, yeah, I guess that's what I'll say. And so, I don't want to talk too much about myself right now, at least, but that's what I'll say.
Yeah. So this leads perfectly into the next quote that we were going to read as an example and counterexample of what to and not to do in the process of discipleship. Part of the process of discipleship.
Oh, sorry. Let me say one thing here.
Yeah.
This thing that Jesus warns us about, that Willard warns us about in the beginning, it becomes really hard to hold, and tell me if I'm going too far with this, if you think I'm wrong, but I think it becomes, in this situation like I just described, where you're, the realness of your faith is what you mentally ascend to, and I use that phrase on purpose, it becomes really hard then to hold people morally accountable for things other than what they say.
Yeah, which is what I'm about to talk about.
Okay.
That's great. So Willard on page 337, so it becomes really hard to hold people accountable for things other than what they say. This is why you get like Mark Driscoll's, right?
Yes.
And the rise and fall.
Who preach great things about, like, dude, his sermon, yeah. I will link it below. No shame. His sermon on, he did a whole series on the Ten Commandments back when I listened to Mark Driscoll.
Yeah.
His sermon on take the Lord's name in vain is fantastic. It's exactly what we talked about in the last episode.
Yeah, that's wild.
But it's so ironic.
But and again, this is because that kind of theology leans itself more towards thinking certain things than being transformed, right? That the left, they take in the opposite direction. It's all about doing and social transformation and that kind of stuff. And that's also bad. But okay, so
and not that, and I want to say this clearly, not that I'm someone who can sit and write judgment of Mark Driscoll, right? Like, judge not lest you be judged. That, like, I want to take that seriously and be like, I have planks in my eyes, bro. Like, I have a lot of things in my life that are not the way that Jesus would want them to be.
Yeah.
And things that I'm trying to rectify, and things that I'm trying to be more sanctified about, and things that I'm working on.
Yeah.
So I'm not here to, you know, to cast pearls before swine, or to judge the speck in Mark Driscoll's eye, as big as I think that speck might be.
Yeah.
But the point, he's just a good example of this, because a whole series was made about how he didn't act the way in which he preached, which you could make series about that by myself. So it's like,
So to not get too bogged down in this, because we've spent a little too much time here already.
Go ahead.
Willard 337, he says, we often speak of people not living up to their faith, but the cases in which we say this are not really cases of people behaving other than they believe. They are cases in which genuine beliefs are made obvious by what people do. We always live up to our beliefs or down to them, as the case may be. And so the reason that I think this is important is because Willard is changing the way we need to think about belief. And when we were talking about defining the word belief and the word faith towards the beginning of this gospel project that we're currently doing, we talked about this. Faith is trust. Trust manifests itself in an action, right? It's not just mental assent. And so I would make the case that Driscoll didn't actually believe properly, and so his actions were tainted. It, like, actions and belief are in this reciprocal relationship, right? And so he might have mentally assented to certain things, but that's not necessarily belief in the biblical sense.
Right.
Belief in the biblical sense is a mental understanding that manifests itself in a new heart disposition and action orientation towards God and others.
Right.
That's belief. And so Willard's point, we live up to our faith or down to it. And so the fruit that we bear is actually a confession of what our beliefs really are. Now, we could have good theory without having good beliefs. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So I think that's an important thing to note, is that we live up to or down to our faith, and that just because you say you believe something, just because you have all the right answers to the quiz, which is Willard's example in chapter one, doesn't mean you can actually do the things necessary, be the kind of person necessary. Right? There's a difference there, a big difference. Anything to add on that before we move forward?
No, I'm trying to find this next quote because I think it's so powerful.
Well, I think I actually do have one more little little bit to say.
Go ahead.
Well, I just lost it. Okay, so as you're finding this quote, I'll intro it a little bit. So, oh yes, yeah, sorry. So this is how this is a positive or a negative, right? We can live down to our faith, but we can also live up to our faith. So when it comes to discipling others and being discipled ourselves, we do have to focus on the things that we think, right? If we're thinking wrong things, our actions are going to be wrong.
Right.
You just can't help that. And so when it comes to discipling others, you do have to include study as a part of that process.
Right.
Because you have to change what people think.
Right.
But it can't just be think. It has to be belief, as we've defined it, manifesting itself in action. Right. And so that is an inherent part of this process. And that's the positive side. We've talked a little bit about the negative side, but the positive side is you do have to start. You can't stay there, but you have to start with changing people's beliefs. And that's why I think sermons are important. Now, do we overemphasize them in the Protestant church more than we should? Probably, because then it becomes a TED talk with a concert on either side of it.
Right.
As opposed to something more. But changing belief is important. And part of changing belief is changing the way we think about things. So you have the quote ready?
Yeah, I do. And I'm so again, I'm going to read a little bit, just
that's fine.
A tad bit more than is on here, but we can go from there. He says, the second thing for us to do, if we are to make apprentices to Jesus, so if we are the ones then making disciples, is to intend to make disciples. This is now a familiar theme of central importance. It must be our conscious objective, consciously implemented, to bring others to the point where they are daily learning from Jesus. Daily learning from Jesus, not necessarily learning just what you believe. Daily learning from Jesus how to live their actual lives as he would live them if he were they, back to what we talked about last episode. That implemented intention would soon transform everything among professing Christians as we know them. For example, much time is spent among Christians trying to smooth over hurt feelings and even deep wounds given and received, and to get people to stop being angry, retaliatory, and unforgiving. But suppose instead we devote our time to inspiring and enabling Christians and others to be people who are not offendable and not angry, and who are forgiving as a matter of course. Great peace, the psalmist says, have they whose love thy law, nothing trips them up. To intentionally make disciples is to open the doorway for people to become like that. That is why it is such a great gift to humankind. And Willard's point here is something I've been saying, actually. So much time spent trying to smooth over hurt feelings and deep wounds, and to get people to stop being angry and retaliatory and unforgiving. But the goal of Jesus, again, is not that just you don't hate your brother, but that you love your enemy so that you are unable to be offended and not angry. And we're forgiving as a matter of course. Oh, you forgive me? Of course I would forgive you. Because every day I pray, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us.
And one another important thing to talk about here is, if you notice what Willard says, stop being angry or retaliatory, or stop being unforgiving. The focus is on the negatives,
right?
Not discipleship. So as I'm discipling you, I'm going to help you not do X. But what happens when you not do X? Well, I don't know what to do then. What's the what do I do? The focus needs to be instead on what do I do? C.S. Lewis talks about this. I think it's the beginning of The Weight of Glory. He says, if you ask the modern person what the greatest virtue is, they'll likely say unselfishness. If you ask the greatest Christians in our faith what the greatest virtue is, they'd say love. And what we've done is we've switched a positive for a negative.
Right.
And so we focus on depriving myself as opposed to loving you.
Right.
Loving right. you has substance. Depriving myself doesn't, for the sake of depriving myself,
right.
doesn't matter. Right. And so it's the same thing here. We have to focus on teaching people how to love, how to forgive, how to do these positive things that fill
right.
us up and those around us, that don't deplete us and leave us without any action step to take.
Right.
I think that's crucially important.
Maybe you don't just need to pray, you know, forgive us our sins as we forgive those who sin against us. Maybe you need to do the other thing that Jesus said, which is, if you remember that your brother has something against you, go and make right. Leave your, we talked about this with moral and ritual purity, leave your gift at the altar and go and reconcile. Maybe you just need to pray for forgiveness or pray that you can forgive. Maybe you need to go ask forgiveness. That would be a way in which this would be enacted.
Yeah. So I'm going to read, I'm actually going to skip that next quote and go to the high priest bit.
Okay.
I'm going to try to skim this because we're going to run out of time. So on page 328, Willard says, we need to be standing in the position of Jesus' students and co-workers so that our efforts in making disciples will be appropriately guided and strengthened by him. They are, after all, to be his disciples, not ours. And this is a crucial, crucial point. Jesus is the high priest.
Right.
Now we,
as Hebrews,
can
says,
function in a priestly role to mediate Jesus' high priesthood to a disciple. And I think that is a crucial step. Right? We are called to do that in the Great Commission, right?
Right.
But they are his disciples. Now, apart, so this is me skimming over that. I could say more, but for sake of time, we need to keep going. There's a way in which we need to have a disciple disposition. We talk a lot in the church, at least church cultures that I grew up in, about, you know, are you being discipled? Who's discipling you? Who's discipling you? We don't ask so much about, are you the kind of person that is discipleable? And I think I've shared this before. I might not have, but I told my wife at one point, and this is something that I've tried to put in practice myself, you, in any and all contexts, you can find someone who, whether or not they know, they're discipling. Because, so I'll use her as an example. She had someone at work that she very much admired. And so my advice to her was, pay attention to that person. Try to spend time with that person. And be intentional with that time about trying to become like the things in that person that
right.
you think reflect Jesus. Whether or not this person's aware of it, their mere presence, if you turn towards them in this way, can be a discipling presence in your life. I've had this done explicitly and implicitly myself. I have people who have explicitly discipled me, and I have people who I've consciously turned towards and said, you know, you're going to be my disciple. So part of being a discipler is inviting people into that process consciously, and then turning them into people who can then do that with other people as well. right? Who can be a disciple in other situations. So I think I'll skip that long quote because it basically just says more or less what I said, unless there's anything that you want to say from that.
No, I think that's great. I think that that's something that not many of us think about is, because at least in my context growing up, it was always make it explicit. And it doesn't always have to be that way.
Explicit is good. I'm not saying explicit
no,
isn't
explicit
good.
Is good because it's more intentional.
Yes, but you can be the kind of person who can be discipled by someone who doesn't know they're discipling. Right? You can set your eye on, I want to become like them, so I'm going to pay attention and I'm going to do what I can to make that happen. I am going to read, because this is really on the topic that we've haven't hit quite as much in this episode as I was thinking we might have, but making disciples. We talked a little bit about the problems that we've run with making disciples, but this I think is important for making disciples. Willard 3:13, he says, a gentle, firm, non-cooperation with things that everyone knows to be wrong, together with a sensitive, non-officious, non-intrusive, non-obsequious service to others. So that, he used a lot of big words there. What he's saying there is non-cooperation with evil, gently but firm, paired with sensitivity and gentleness towards others, should be our usual overt manner. And this is how we make disciples and attract people to the disciple-making process, is we live a life that attracts people to the kind of person that we are becoming in Christ.
Right.
To make them look at us and say, I want to be like that. I can think of so many Christians who are all about conversion, and I don't want to be a thing like them, because they are intrusive, offensive, all of the other big words that he says, not sensitive at all. They don't cooperate with anything other than their own will and force, because they're so focused on making converts and not disciples. So he says, this should be combined with an inward attitude of constant prayer for whatever kind of activity our workplace requires, and genuine life for everyone involved. So it's this kind of attitude that I think is key to disciple making. You won't be able to make disciples if people aren't willing to buy what you're selling, to put it crudely. Mm-hmm. And what we are trying to not sell people, but give people, is a clear picture of what it means to be a citizen of God's kingdom. That's a lot. Like, Jesus lived in God's kingdom, and to use Willard's phrase, he applied that kingdom for the good of others, and even makes it possible that for them to enter it themselves, right? So we have to live a life that can serve as that invitation. And that's the first step towards making disciples. Anything you want to add?
No, I think that's great. And the essence is, again, the kind of person that you are.
Yeah. I mean, he talks about we lead people to become disciples by ravishing them with a vision of life in the kingdom and fellowship with Jesus. You know, that's the kind of what's the phrase? Honey attracts more.
Vinegar. You can attract more bees with honey than vinegar.
Yeah. So, and it's not to say that you don't need to. I mean, he even says, right, a firm stance, firm non-cooperation with things that everyone knows to be wrong. So it's not to say you don't stand firm. You're not hard and fast on the things you need to be hard and fast on. But your disposition has to be one that can attract, right?
Let's get to this last quote here, because I think we talked earlier. I think we each have a few things to say about this, so I want to give us time, because I think this is going to be an important distinction we make. But Willard here says, he says, one of the greatest weaknesses in our teaching and leadership today is that we spend so much time trying to get people to do things good people are supposed to do without changing what they really believe. And I think this is a good example. He says, I once heard a pastor explaining to his congregation how it caused his stomach to hurt when people did not come to the evening service on which he had worked so hard. I've been a pastor and I can understand how he felt, but he would have been more effective had he simply dealt with the beliefs of his people that kept them home on Sunday evenings.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that that's true. The one thing I will say that is a little bit different than what Willard's pointing at here is that I think many times beginning to do the thing that you know is right, that you know is good, before you fully believe what it might be or what it means, can then help you believe. This is that relationship between belief and action that we were talking about earlier, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I pray the Lord's Prayer before I really think, but can I really forgive people as I'm forgiven? But maybe as you pray that, you will start to be able to do that. And maybe, like I said last episode, as you pray the Jesus Prayer, it will start to make sense. Maybe as you do even these simple practices, maybe as you fast, not to be seen by others, but to remind yourself of your limitation and to call upon the grace of God. As you pray, as you fast, as you give to the needy, before you fully believe that you're ready for the thing, then it will start. Maybe if you go to church, even if you're like, oh, I don't really want to go on Sunday night or whatever it might be, Sunday morning or Saturday night or whatever. But if you start to go, then maybe you'll see that this is really, maybe it will change your belief, and then your belief will follow your action. So anything else you want to say here in the last bit?
No, I mean, just everything I mentioned about Driscoll and that whole belief in action thing at the beginning fits perfectly right here. Those two things are related, and if we don't change one,